We're going to open into prayer. Okay?
Oh, Lord, we thank you so very much for this gorgeous, gorgeous weather that you've given us. Yes. And really for the weather that you've given us for the entire connection.
Yes, God.
Lord, this is the day that you've made, and we fully, fully intend to continue to rejoice and be glad in it.
Yes.
I thank you for the opportunity to educate my brothers and my sisters. And Lord, I just ask that each and every person who is present would have an open heart and open ears and open minds. God, I ask that you would help them to articulate whatever it is that they need to ask, and do so without fear. And Lord, that we can do this whole thing in love. In Jesus' name.
Amen.
Yo, homegirl, what's up? Excuse me? I heard there was going to be this bootsy workshop on diversity. I thought there would be some homegirls I could kick it with. Homegirls you could kick it with? Who are you anyway?
Yo, sister, my name is Tracy. But my homegirls call me T-Wannabe.
Clearly. Miss T-Wannabe. Well, yes, there is a diversity workshop. And I would encourage you to attend.
Why are you hating on the white girl? You all for my Kool-Aid and you don't even know flavor.
Oh, must Jesus, there's a cross.
You something. Oh, when we gonna get this party started?
Oh, this party about to get started right now. You need to hush and have a seat. That would be one of the don'ts.
One?
A few of the don'ts. Actually, a few.
Oh, we'll get there.
I'm a professional.
But you know what?
But your braids is key.
She's got it going on, like no other.
Go ahead.
This
is what we're doing, just starting off from the top. It's just, we're going to have, is Martin still there? To read our mission statement so that you know, for people that don't know exactly what it is, that the Diversity Committee is all about and what it is that we do and why we were asked to do the work that we're doing.
Diversity Committee is a family of evangelicals concerned Western Region members who seek to enhance the mission and outreach of ECWR by addressing the needs of excluded LGBT Christians who come to ECWR seeking recognition, inclusion, and fellowship as part of a Christian community striving to fully reflect the body of Christ.
Okay, so I will briefly share with you why we're doing this workshop, and
and for those that don't know by now, I'm Keith Butler.
And I'm Davina Wilson. And this is
James Lynn.
And that is
Sheila Northcutt.
And homegirl is T-Wannabe.
That's your AKA T-Wannabe.
And one more.
Oh, Martin Fowler. All members of the Diversity Committee.
And Mark Nelson is not with us, but he is also an active member of the Diversity Committee. All right, why are we doing this workshop? We're doing this workshop because, let me start with the Diversity Committee first of all. The Diversity Committee came into being because we recognized that there was a need, okay? And when I say we, I'm talking about primarily people of color. When I will talk about Keith and I, because we're present and we can speak for ourselves, okay? So when he and I came to Connection the first year we came, we were here together at the same time. So our first year was the same first year. And we immediately noticed that, well, ECWR was somewhat anemic, okay? Melanin challenged, if you will. And we were curious about that. And we talked about it, and we talked with the executive board about it, and they decided, okay, let's do something about it. And it wasn't only us. There were other people mm-hmm. of other ethnicities who felt the same way. So we came together, and we had a meeting that year, and decided to put together, the executive board decided to put together a diversity committee, and that is how we were born.
And a lot of it came out of too was because the executive board, the great hearts that they have at that time as well, they wanted to find out how to reach out and to, you know, to bring in more people of color to this organization. Because a lot of people are saying, you know, we're a little white organization, as you can see, but we know that there are African Americans out there that would want to be a part of this organization or come to Connection. How do we reach out to them? And then when they asked that, they printed up these flyers and pamphlets, but there was never a person of color there. So what we came to understand was that when we ask how we reach out, but then we don't make an attempt to reach out, then the asking was never important to begin with. You know, so, you know, what happened was in a dialogue that we had with the e-board that year, we was able to understand that there are not only just issues about us, but there's a lot of other issues, and there needs to be a separate committee formed in order to make sure that these issues get discussed when we're all together as a family every year at Connection.
Mm-hmm. And let me say that the board was just really, they have been so supportive of the work that we're doing. I know that initially there were concerns, they weren't sure, you know, how it was going to happen, how it would be received, and those were very natural and very normal concerns. And when we, the May before last Connection, we met, the diversity committee met with the executive board, and we presented to them what we were planning to do for our workshop. And I mean, they were literally on the edges of their seats going, oh my gosh. We couldn't believe the things that we were sharing. We were sharing experiences that we had had just within the community and experiences that we had had at Connection. And of course, they didn't have a clue. First of all, it's not their reality. Racial discrimination was not their reality. So they don't know what goes on for us. But they also didn't know that these things were happening right here at EC. And so they were so pleased with what we were going to do, and they were very, very optimistic. So they have been nothing less than unbelievably supportive of the work that we're doing. And we love the work that we do. It's hard work, what we do. And we do put ourselves on the front lines, because this is hard stuff for people to deal with. It's hard stuff for people to look at. It's really hard to have to look inside and go, oh my gosh, I'm racist. Oh my gosh, I'm guilty of making racist statements. Oh, I had no idea I was a bigot in this area. That is hard to acknowledge about ourselves. But the sooner we're able to come to terms with what's going on for us, who we are, and be open and willing to learn.
And communicate,
the better life is gonna be for all of us. The better we're going to be able to get along. So that's why the Diversity Committee is doing the work that it's doing, because we want everyone to feel welcome here. We want everyone to feel accepted. And why can't we all just get along?
And we want to also preface too that a lot of the references that we're going to make are not necessarily just going to be pertaining to the gay community, because in a lot of instances, thank you very much. We can walk out of here and go out to the world and not even tell anybody that we're gay, for a lot of us, you know. So these are also tools that are going to help everybody in the society as a whole. It's not just the gay community. We're going to talk about a lot of experiences that happen to us within the gay community, but all of these things are when you're out in the world as a whole, when you're outside of the gay community.
And you also need to know that the issues that the Diversity Committee deals with are not just racial issues. We deal with issues of discrimination, that would be racism and bigotry.
And inclusion.
Okay. So, just so that you know, it happens that today we're going to be talking about discrimination, racism against African Americans. That's what we're talking about today. We began this conversation last year, and we were asked to continue because it's just a big subject and we weren't able to complete it, Tracy.
Well, there's lots of areas that this committee has been tasked to look at and start working on. For instance, yesterday in the open forum section, we talked about theological diversity and bisexuality. So there's a myriad of issues. It's overwhelming that this committee is going to have to begin to a dialogue. Mm-hmm.
And the other thing is that, you know, what we talked about, theology and bisexuality, that forum went very well. It was very well received. And that was just the beginning of dialogue about those subjects. And so we intend to create workshops around Western subjects and many, many more. So we just want you to be aware of that. Okay, last year we started and we talked about racial discrimination within the community as it pertains to African Americans. And as I said, we were not able to, I mean, it's just one of those subjects that, you know, we can spend the next 6 or 7 years talking about and never be done. But we weren't able to just cover all the information that we wanted to cover.
Especially the education part.
Right. And so we want to really get into the education piece this time. We will still share experiences. We will still share a lot of stuff. But we really want to get the education piece out to you so that you can go out enlightened.
Yeah. And also to make sure, too, that we have enough time to dialogue. Mm-hmm. We didn't have that time last mm-hmm. time to dialogue with each other and have an opportunity for people to ask questions.
Yeah, we really want to answer your questions. And so what I would like for you to do right now is I would like you to just take up just a split second and just think about what it was that drew you to this workshop. Okay. Don't need to speak about it, but I do want you to think about it. Okay, we have some. And as you're thinking about what it was that drew you to this workshop,
oh no, I need a pen and pencil. Okay, pencil right here.
There you go.
The other thing is that you need to know that even though we did some of this last year, this workshop itself is a standalone workshop, so you don't have to have been there last year. Okay. So now, as you're thinking about what it was that drew you to the workshop, I would like you to take a moment and just write down on the little index card that you received any questions that might come up for you, that might have already come up for you today, that might have come up for you as you read the description of the workshop, things that might have shown up in life, you know, just questions that you might have, anything.
That you want an answer to.
Yeah.
You know, we're open, we're standing here today, not as a representation of the whole African American community, but as a representation of ourselves to be able to answer the questions that you might have.
And we would ask that you be honest in your questioning and that you know,
whatever it is.
Mm-hmm, don't be afraid.
Don't be around the bush. Just come right out and see it.
And we will talk about all sorts of things, whatever comes up. However, if we want you to feel safe enough to share anything you want and need to share here. And if something that you share, you feel that you don't want to go on the CD, you just have to tell us and we will edit it out. So just know that you are safe. So go ahead and take a moment and write down the questions. And if you don't have a question, that's okay too. And something may come up while we're talking, you can write down that.
Thanks.
Okay.
Will there be time for live open discussion?
Yes.
Most of the workshop will be dialogue.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. But is it limited to this subject or can...
We have to limit it to this subject because that's what the workshop's about.
Yeah.
Okay.
But we can talk after.
And when you're done with your questions, just pass them to your right, and James will pick those up.
The question that we would
pass. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Any questions that you might have.
Anonymous.
Yes.
Don't put your name on.
Don't put your name on. No, we wouldn't tell. Even if you put your name on, we wouldn't say your name. We will publish it in the cable, but.
Jokes there.
Could you just briefly explain what the terms collateral damage and friendly fire mean? Oh, okay.
Do you want me to explain it now?
No, if you're going to get to it, I can wait.
It's just a little bit of a pun on words, but we're just really talking about things that you said that offended. Friendly fire, things that you said that hurt, but we didn't know it was. Does that make sense? No.
Is that a cell phone?
No.
Okay, well, time's up.
That's what that is.
That's the timer.
Uh-huh. Is that the 2 minute timer?
Uh-huh. Yeah, it is the timer. Oh, yes,
excellent.
Truly. So you can go ahead and
start. Excellent. Okay.
Did Just as you're finishing your questions, please just pass them down. James will collect them.
Soft targets for black girls. He was arrested and detained for nailing Barbie doll heads to telephone poles. He was beaten while in custody, accused of defacing public property. After healing, he resumed his irreverent campaign. This outlaw spoke terrorist continued hammering horse nails through Barbie heads and setting them aflame. Barbie never told black girls that they are beautiful. She never acknowledged their breathtaking nippertude. She never told them to possess their own souls. They were merely shadows clenching the edges of her mirror. Barbie never told black girls that they are beautiful, not in the ghetto evenings after Double Dutch, nor in the integrated suburbs after ballet class. As you'll see in your stuff that you have, that there are a number of, there's a resource reading list, recommended reading list. And basically what that is just some books that we thought would be helpful for people to understand what it is to be African American, what it is to be gay in African America. That book actually was by Essex Hemphill, a gay African American activist who's no longer with us, but he has some really good stuff in there. So when you get a chance, you know, look over that, and if you ever have questions about things or want to know more about people and the lives of African Americans, some writers and things, that list would be really helpful for you.
Okay. On that list also, well, you've got your 7 books on there. The one that I brought to show you is a book by Audre Lorde. It's called Zami, A New Spelling of My Name. It's her autobiography. And she, how many of you know who Audre Lorde is? Okay, Audre Lorde is African American. She describes herself as, she says, I am African American, I am a woman, I am lesbian, I am a mother, I am a poet, I am a writer, I am an activist. She's all those things that owe so much. She's also my hero. She talks in this book just about her life and what it was like growing up in Harlem. Her parents were from Grenada, and they were immigrants here. And she was born and raised in Harlem, and then she moved out of Harlem and went to Mexico, and then moved back to New York. And so she just talks about what it was like growing up wearing all of those hats. It was not easy. There's nothing in that book that was easy that she experienced. Nothing. You were given or picked up.
Okay. Pick up.
Okay. A couple of articles. One called Why Whites Think Blacks Have No Problems.
And let me know the authors.
Yes. The author of this this piece is Tim Wise, and he is a white man. And the other piece you received was on white privilege, and it is called Unpacking, is that what it is? Unpacking the Invisible Knapsack?
On the Invisible Privilege.
Yeah, it's on a piece that Peggy McIntosh wrote on white privilege, and she is a white woman. Both of these authors have come to terms not only with their whiteness, but with their white privilege. And it was a rude awakening for both of them. And so what I would like to do is just go through this particular article with you, just pick out a few points, and give you an idea of what Tim Wise is talking about. And hopefully it will whet your appetite enough that you will read the article. It is extremely informative. Both pieces are extremely informative. So I just want to talk about a little bit of what he's talking about in this particular article. He starts the article with just a few years ago, a public opinion poll indicated that only 6% of whites in the United States believed racism was still a very serious facing African Americans. And then he goes on to say that when you consider that twice that number, or as many as 12%, have told pollsters they believe Elvis Presley is still alive, it becomes apparent that delusion has taken on a whole new meaning amongst the dominant racial majority. And he jokes a little bit about that. And then he says, it makes me think, this is probably my favorite line in the whole piece, he says, it makes me think that if ignorance is indeed bliss, then my fellow whites must be among the happiest folks on the planet. And he's making light of it, but it's very serious. This is a very serious topic, okay? And basically he's saying that his fellow whites, the dominant majority, often don't have a clue about what's going on for African Americans or other people of color for that matter. And it's because, I think, that a big reason is because it's just not the reality, you know. I mean, I live it. I live the discrimination. I deal with it every day of my life. So I know what's going on for me. I know what's going on for people of color. And I also know what goes on for white people. But that's because I live in America and I'm forced to be bicultural. I must know white culture in order to survive in America. But I'm also African American, so, you know, I have my culture as well. White people have the privilege of not having to be bicultural. You know, you can be white in this country and survive quite nicely and never have to interact with people of another ethnicity if you don't want to. If you choose to isolate and be among your own, you can. That is a privilege that you have. We don't have that privilege. And that is a part of the next piece. But anyway, that's what he was alluding to. So then he goes on to say that 7 out of 10 whites believe that blacks are treated equally in their communities. 8 in 10 whites say blacks receive equal educational opportunities, and 83% say that blacks receive equal housing opportunities in their communities. And only a third of whites believe blacks face racial bias from police in their areas. Again, it's all about your reality and where you're coming from. And then he goes on to talk about, he gets very specific about housing, about education. Despite the fact that half of all blacks say that they have experienced discrimination in the past 30 days, whites persist in believing that we know their realities better than they do, and that black complaints of racism are the rantings of oversensitive racial hypochondriacs. Of course, this ignorance is in part the result of our isolation from African Americans in daily life. And he says more than 80% of whites live in virtually all white neighborhoods, and that's absolutely true and proven time and time again. This I found very interesting because it's about employment, and the issues around employment in this country for African Americans versus whites is just so real, and it's so big, it's huge. He says that even though blacks search for work longer and often more aggressively than whites, they are between 36 to 44% less likely to be hired for jobs in mostly white suburbs, even when their experience and qualifications are equal to their white counterparts. And this I found exceptionally interesting. White males with a high school diploma are just as likely to have a job and tend to earn just as much as black males with college degrees. And then he talks about de facto segregation as it occurs in schools. And he talks about how children, he goes right down to kindergartners, how children in schools take standardized tests and are judged based on the results of those tests. Well, most people who know anything about standardized tests know, I shouldn't say most people, a lot of people who know about standardized tests know that standardized tests are skewed. And they do not take into consideration the learning styles or abilities of African American students, of Latino students, of any other children of color. Those tests are geared toward white children. So then, the results of those scores, of course, are going to be skewed because those things are not taken into consideration. And so then, African American children in particular end up in special ed classes. They end up in lower skilled courses. It's a travesty what happens for these children. I work in schools, I know what happens. I have children, and I know what happens. I know what's happened to my own children in schools. I have not allowed my children to take standardized tests. I will never, and I will never encourage a parent of color to allow their children to take standardized tests, except an SAT when they're a senior, so that they can get into college. Otherwise, I would never encourage them to do that, because unless they are, you know, brilliant according to the test scores, they are not, whatever they have up here is not going to be known by the test givers. So he talks a lot about that in this article as well. And he also goes into housing and the discrimination that occurs for African Americans in just even renting an apartment. Of course, I can attest to that. Also with buying property, home loans. I think he says that, blacks are 56% more likely than whites to be rejected for a mortgage loan. Okay. I know about that. Nationwide, mortgage loan rejection rates for the highest income group of blacks is roughly the same as the rejection rates for the lowest income whites.
What?
He says that nationwide, mortgage rejection rates for the highest income group for blacks are the same as the lowest income group for whites.
How about employment? When a white person and a black person is up against each other for the same job.
Do you really want me to go there?
What?
Yeah, I'll tell you what happens.
Go there.
I'm going. You guys, I didn't. He made me. Here's what typically happens.
Okay.
I say typically because it's certainly not always the case, and there's nothing that's absolute. But here is often what happens. And I'll share from my own experience, okay? I will go and apply for a job. I'm in that process right now as we speak. I have an education. I have a master's degree. I'll have a doctorate December or before, as soon as I finish my dissertation. I will apply for this job. A white person, male or female, will apply for the same job. They don't see me. All they see me is on paper. All they know me on paper. And so I get this glowing letter or phone call, oh my gosh, we can't wait to talk with you, can we schedule an interview? Of course, they're talking to me on the phone, so they don't know that I'm African American because, my gosh, I sound so white. So they're just very enthusiastic and excited, and I go for the interview, and they see that I'm African American. That doesn't work, that doesn't go over too well, first of all. And we sit down and we have the interview. I will, of course, share my experience and answer all of their questions. And they will inevitably tell me that I'm overqualified for the job, or that they'll get back to me, or they haven't quite made a decision yet, or they may not be quite ready to hire just yet. They were just trying to put out feelers to see what the response might be. That's just a few of the things that happened for me. Now, that white woman that was sitting next to me, who has an AA, from a community college will go in, and she's blonde, and she's maybe wearing a short skirt, I don't know, I dress very professionally when I go on an interview, but she will go in and she will cross her legs and say, gosh, I would just love to have this job, and they go, oh, you're hired. That's happened to me, I can't tell you how many times.
What's your field?
I'm sorry?
What's your field of study? What you
do? I'm a social worker.
Oh. Mm-hmm.
So, I've done a lot of different things, but I am a social worker by trade. When I apply for positions for county, if I'm going to work for CPS, they might be more inclined to hire me, but that's because they have huge caseloads of African American children. And my gosh, who's going to handle those unruly kids? So, that's been my experience.
And a lot of times when we've done talks and stuff together, you know, I never really talk about my experiences in my career as an actor. And my experiences in my career as an actor is that I don't look at a script and say where it doesn't say there's a black character in it. For me, I go and audition for everything. I totally blew this woman out of the water one day when I walked in to audition for Forever Plaid. If anybody knows the musical Forever Plaid, there's no black guys in Forever Plaid. You know? But for me, it was to go in for the experience. And then, of course, I walked in and she was like, can I help you? What are you in for? And I was like, you know, I just for Forever Plaid. She's like, oh, okay. All right. You know? And then once they got me in and they found that I could sing, and that I had a great resume as an actor, and then they invited me back. You know, we're doing this musical. There isn't a role for you in this, but we're glad you're here. We got to see what you can do. We're doing this musical next month. Can you come back and audition for us for again? You know, so I'm probably one of the few African-American actors that don't look for the role that says he's African-American. I go out and I audition for everything. And I've been cast in a lot of things where directors took a chance to say, I'm doing a colorblind cast. I got to play Malcolm in Macbeth, you know? I mean, one of the third leads in a wonderful Shakespearean play, you know? And I was the only black person in the cast. you know. But it was because the director said he's an actor. Mm-hmm. And it's not about what his color is. It's about his ability, and he has the ability to do it. So it's about me going out there and putting myself out there and said, don't just look at me, you know. Just know that I have the ability to do this.
And I can say that was my experience when I was in theater as well.
Thank you for the meeting.
That was very different. When I was in theater, I was not discriminated against in that way. But when I was in theater, I was a dancer. And so, you know, we can sing and dance. So I always had a job. But I mean, I didn't see that discrimination. Other African Americans would audition for roles. And if they made the cut, I mean, if they were good, if they were better than the others that auditioned, they got the part. It is a different, slightly different role. It's not the same in Hollywood. Not the same in Hollywood. And one last thing I'll say about employment is that I have two sons. And we moved to Stockton 2 years ago. Stockton used to be an extremely racist city. Town. It's now a city, a booming metropolis, and many, many people from the Bay Area are moving into Stockton, and that is the only reason I was willing to move there. It's really changing a lot. My sons, we've been there for 2 years, and my sons have yet to find a job. Okay, my sons are, and this is not a mother talking, this is a human being talking. I have attractive sons, you know my sons. Tell them how fine they are.
They're just the most handsome men.
No, they are very attractive young men. They are
very helpful.
They're articulate young men. They're hard, hard working young men. They have yet to find a job. 2 years.
I know I talked to you earlier.
Yes, you did.
You know what you heard when you went on those interviews? Mm-hmm. I can honestly tell you, I heard the same thing.
I said people of color.
Three years. Well, I pass. You know, as a Hispanic in Southern California, it isn't that easy, especially in conservative Orange County. I've been told by a high-profile type recruiter that people of color don't do well in Orange County. And in fact, the only black people that I saw employed in a corporation traveled from LA. So it isn't a good thing, but I've heard those very same things. But I don't think it's as much of my Hispanic blood, but I'm older and I'm heavy. Mm-hmm. And because I get in the door. My resume, among others, gets me in the door. Mm-hmm.
And I get in the door too, as long as they don't see me first.
Right. So,
and you said something that's just really important.
I pass. Mm-hmm. You know.
I can't. I pass on the phone, and I've done that a lot. I have had jobs where I've made contact by phone, and then I will go out to meet the CEO or whoever I'm talking to, and they are wonderful. Wonderful on that phone. Oh, I can't wait to meet you. Great. And then I get there and they have more than once walked right past me looking for Ms. Wilson. And I'm the only one in the lobby.
Professionally, I experience
that. And then when they see that, they're just like, I'll go up to, it's amusing to me. I just didn't watch them, you know. And then when they come back and they realize nobody out there, me and the secretary will say, you know. And then the guy will come to me and go, oh, are you Ms. Wilson? You know, it's like, don't. You know, I mean, it's funny, but it's just not funny. Okay. And that's happened to me countless times because the way I sound on the phone.
The other handout, Sheila can read a couple of those. And we're just going to have you just read like five of those straight, one right through five.
One that I thought was really interesting is I can easily buy, this is by a white person saying, I don't have to deal with these types of issues. I can easily buy posters, postcards, calendars, picture books, greeting cards, dolls, toys, and children's magazines featuring people of my race.
Go ahead, do another.
I can be pretty sure that if I asked to talk to a person in charge of something, I would be facing a person of my race. If I go into a music shop and count on finding music of my race represented, into a supermarket, I can find the staple of foods that fit in my cultural traditions. And if I go to a hairdresser shop, I can find somebody who can cut my hair.
So who's this talking?
This is a white person.
Kenny McIntosh.
Saying that, I don't have to think about these things. I go into the store, it's there.
And what she's basically saying, that you have a handout with you. What she's basically saying is, as a white person, I have privilege. I'm able to get the things that I need wherever I go. You know, and I know this is, to a lot of people, they go, well, you know, maybe that's not, but it's a reality though. Mm-hmm. It's an absolute, and you know, Davina didn't, we didn't say this in the beginning because we've said it before, but I'll say it now by saying, you know, people will say, well, you know, we're all gay people. We're all doing this. We're all fighting a struggle to be accepted. But you know, as a gay person, you can walk up to a counter and not tell anybody that you're gay. And they can see that you're white. But I can walk up to a counter and they can see that I'm black. And I don't have to tell them that I'm gay either. But I'm not going to get the same treatment that you're going to get. So there is a difference. Racism and homophobia are two different things that we deal with.
But both call for huge trouble. There is huge trouble for both. It's just those troubles are not the same always. I just want you to know that Peggy McIntosh is a professor at Wellesley College, and she works in the women's studies department. Okay, she does research on women a lot. Okay. Let me make sure I get all the cards.
We want to make sure that we have time to dialogue with each other and to give some tools, because that's what, you know, we basically talk about, is that we want to be able to give you some tools to walk away with, so that people aren't walking around like Sheila said, you know, I can go, okay, I want to go talk to those people, but I would talk to that person, but I don't want to say the wrong thing. So what we're going to do is, this is part is, we're going to help educate and say, this is what you should say, or this is how you should think. You know, in approaching a situation.
We want to say these are some suggestions.
Yeah.
I don't want to say what you should or shouldn't do, but I am happy to make suggestions. Okay, so we'll start with you.
Number one, I don't see color. I have people all the time that say, you know, I don't see color. When I see you, Keith, I don't see you as a black man. Well, to me, what you're saying is you don't see me. Because the first thing that you have to see about me is the fact that I'm black. That's a part of who I am. I can't erase it and I can't change it. So you have to see the fact that I am black first. And then you get to know me. What I think a lot of people are saying, and what I think would be a great suggestion for people to say, is that Keith, when I see you, the fact that you're black doesn't stop me from getting to know who you are. Mm-hmm. That comes from a different place than saying, and I know, and we know that a lot of times, a lot of the things that we're going to say, that there are a lot of people who do not have ill intentions in saying these things. But a lot of times, if we don't correct now what people are saying, they are going to run into the wrong person, and it's not going to be pretty, you know. So it's good now to, when you say that, think about what does that mean when I say I don't see color? What am I saying? What am I actually referring to? What am I actually experiencing with they mean when I'm looking at this person saying that?
And how's it coming across to the person receiving it? Okay. Number two, stating ethnicity when you're telling a story. You know what? When you tell a story, unless the person's ethnicity is pertinent to the story, why do you feel a need to even say what the ethnicity is?
Exactly.
I have a problem with you stating a gender, if it's pertinent to the story. But I mean, you don't need to state a person's ethnicity, but people inevitably do it. They don't even think, it doesn't even occur to them that they're doing it. But people do it all the time. And Lord, it happens with me all the time. People, when they're telling me a story that has an African-American person's story, oh, they can't wait to tell me that the lead player in the story is African-American. And I couldn't care less. Just tell me, just to cut to the chase. What's the story? What is it you're trying to say?
As if you know the person or you're responsible
exactly.
for the conduct.
Exactly. Yeah. And they don't even know the person a lot of times, you know. They're telling me a story about something that happened in the grocery store, the black woman behind me, stuff like that. So careful with stating ethnicity. If it's pertinent to the story, please state it. But if it's not pertinent, it's unnecessary.
Number three, some of my best friends are black. I know some of us have heard that. Some of my best friends are gay. You know? So your point is, if you're saying to me, you know, I don't have a problem with knowing who you are and I like you, you know, then just say that. The fact that you have black friends doesn't qualify who I am to you though, does it? I don't know who those people are, and I don't have anything to do with those people. So you like me. Thank you. You like me and you accept me. Say, I like you and I accept you for who you are. Telling me that you have black friends doesn't mean anything to me. What it's saying to me is that you're saying, so it's okay for us to deal with each other because I've already dealt with this before. You know, I play with black people over here too, so it's okay for you and me to be together.
I can do this. Okay, I'm so glad.
Oh, I'm sorry, I didn't get to do for that. Yeah. I did.
Okay,
I'm sorry.
Yeah,
you did.
Okay, number four is the backbone of the origin of the diversity committee. When Keith and I first came to Connection, I mean, you guys, you know, Keith is my brother. You guys probably thought that we just came together, and you know, that, you can think that. We showed up here and we met here at Connection, but he really is my brother. And my mom would have been so happy to own him. But this is the backbone of the origin of the Diversity Committee. When we first, our first year here, people came up to us and said, I had more than one someone come up to me and hug me, and I felt the hug was genuine, and their intention was genuine, but they said to me, I'm so glad you're here, we need more like you. And I went, but we need more women? You need more tall women? You need more women with big feet? What does that mean? I mean, there are other people, other African Americans that I know, who would have lost their religion behind a comment like that? Because it comes across in such an ugly way. It makes the speaker look ugly. It's derogatory. And even if they have, and I believe those people that said that to me had the best intentions. I really believe that with all my heart. But I also know how it came across, and I know how other people would have received it. If they had said something like that to somebody out in the world, I mean, I'm serious, they might have got slapped. I mean, they would have gotten told off. And I know people would have told them off. My sister would have told them off behind that. You know, so we just have to be so careful about what might have been a more acceptable thing to say to me would have stopped with, I'm so glad you're here. Or, I'm so glad you're here. I really wish there were more African Americans here or more people of color here. You know, clearly EC is a melanin challenged organization. There are a lot of white people, and I would love to see more color. That, I would have had no problem with that, none at all whatsoever. But to tell me we need more people like me, that doesn't work for me. I didn't shy away from the person that said that physically, but internally I did step back a little bit because I'm thinking, where's that coming from? So think about how the words that you're speaking are being received. That's all I'm saying.
Stereotypes and assumptions. A lot of people have a lot of stereotypes and assumptions, and I face it a lot. Being an African-American gay man, who my preference is Caucasian men. That's my preference, that's what I'm attracted to. That's another workshop. But that's what I'm attracted to. And a lot of times I run into situations where white men will automatically assume what my music taste is, what my food taste is, what my clothing taste is. I mean, it's always amazing. It's amazing to me how a stereotypical thing such as I get invited to someone's house and they automatically assume that the music I want to listen to is Dr. Dre. And I'll be honest with you, until I, you know, heard of Dr. Dre, I didn't know who Dr. Dre was. But because I was black, they automatically assumed that I knew who this rapper was, you know?
And
that I liked him, absolutely. You know, and what Tracy said last time, which made so much perfect sense, is that they didn't take the opportunity, they welcomed me to their home. I wanted to feel who they were and get to know who they are. So I wish they would have played their music, whatever it was that they liked. Because 9 times out of 10, I'm very eclectic when it comes to music. And I probably would have said, oh, I know so-and-so, I like that, that's really nice. But don't make assumptions or assume because I'm black that I fit a stereotype, that's the only kind of music that I listen to.
And that you only cry.
Because I would love to walk in and hear some Reba McEntire.
On this particular issue though, this works both ways, I think, too.
Mm-hmm. What do you mean?
I mean, and you can certainly correctly assume I don't dance worth a shit, right?
Mm-hmm. I don't assume that. No, I would have assumed
to 30 years ago, but not today.
Oh.
There was a day.
Uh-huh. And I've gotten this, no doubt about it. It comes back at me. Mm-hmm. Assumptions made about me, my weight, because I'm big. There's an assumption there. That would be correct, but it's still an assumption.
Or because you're gay.
People make assumptions about that. But again, that doesn't
show. If they knew, they would make assumptions about that as well. Okay. Don't act, talk, and walk. You all remember Team Wannabe. Please, if you want to be my friend, please just be who you are. You do not need to act black, you don't need to talk black, you don't need to walk black, you don't need to eat black. I don't even like chitlins, okay, so don't be inviting me over your house for some chitlins. I'm not going to talk about you.
I hate chitlins.
Yes.
I'm from Oklahoma.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I've had a problem with that because I love chitlins.
But honey, that's your problem. No, but what do you
think? I've gone to like a pop, like it worked for one of the judges who was just firing this plaque. And I was had only been there for a short time, and they had like two tables of food set up. And I started going over to where the cornbread and the collard greens and all that good stuff was. I said, Bill, you know what this is? He said, it's food. He said, but it's black food. You should go over to that table. This is black people telling me I should go over to the other table. So I said, no, I'm Oklahoma. This is ocean food.
Where was that? Did that happen?
Los Angeles.
Oh, that's now that's interesting to me. Okay, I would. If you said that happened in Oklahoma, I'd say consider the source. But it happened in Los Angeles. I can't explain that. All I know, you said it's for a judge.
It was for a judge. It was retired.
Was a judge black?
Yes. And they had two tables set up, you know, with soul food.
Hence the menu.
The food was segregated. It wasn't you had to eat, but they were trying to say, oh, Bill, your kind of food is over there.
How did that feel for you? That's what I want to know. How did that feel for you when they said that to you?
It hurt.
And I said,
okay, this is what we eat, you know?
And I think it's interesting that the food was segregated.
But see, they never did that.
That's not normal, Billy.
That
is not normal.
I'm going to take that pile of chitlins and put it right over there with those hamburgers.
With the steak, Keith. I've never heard of such a thing, but I hear what you're saying. I've never heard of such a thing. And obviously it does happen. But all I'm saying is, please just be who you are, okay? You don't need to be talking. Don't try to talk jive. Don't talk jive to me. I'm going to bust out another language. You know, I speak other language. And if somebody did that to me, I would do that. I have been known to do that because I resent it so much. That is not who you are. So don't present that way to me. Just be, it's okay to be who you are. I'm going to love you for who you are, not for being a wannabe. It's going to make you look like a fool, too.
I'm not a spokesperson. Don't assume that I can answer all the questions for all the black people on the face of the earth. I can't. Just like I can't answer all the questions for all the gay people on the face of the earth. You know, what is the do for this is, Keith, this is an experience that I had. Is this the culture that you as an African American are prone to, or something that you do, or is this just an isolated incident that I experienced? That means you're getting to know who I am, and you're asking me for what my experience is. But if you come to me and go, so why do y'all act that way? Why do y'all do that? Why do black people do that? I don't know why they do that. I know why I do what I do, and I can only answer for me. I can't answer for everybody else.
When you answer like that, Keith, do you get an attitude back from the people? Because I'm feeling, I've never felt racist, but I know I've said these things, and I can defend some of the things that I've said, like I've met black people and tried to be their friend, and they sort of told me I couldn't because I couldn't possibly relate, and would come up with, I've had friends that were black, I was in the service, I lived. You know, so I would come up with those things. And I also know that me being from New York, if it's in my head, it's out my mouth. Mm-hmm. And especially
if I'm black. You should have been black.
So, if I'm very comfortable with people, I sometimes don't check what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. And I'll just feel relaxed, and if you know, some Joe Schmo that was black came up and said something to me that offended me, and I couldn't talk, I would be, why do you people do that? Mm-hmm. But I wouldn't expect you to answer for the whole black nation, mm-hmm. just that maybe you could give me some insight, just like I feel people group all the whites into one big category, and we're not all white.
And so I think the response, the good response would be, it's because you're asking me, why do you people do that? You're asking him, why do you people do that?
I'm just thinking.
As this scenario.
I think what I'm basically getting down to is that I just think sometimes people feel so comfortable mm-hmm. that we don't think about it.
Say, and are you comfortable because you know that person?
I would think, yeah. If that was something that I was doing, yeah. I would have no problem, you know, me and you buddying around mm-hmm. and like I said someone. You're like, why do you guys do that for?
And I think that's interesting because I would know, because I know you, I would know where that's coming from. Mm-hmm. You know, when you say, you know, why do black people do that? I would know where that's coming from because I know where you're coming from. But if a total stranger that I just met, if we're sitting, I mean, it happens. I've been in a predominantly white establishment and I just met a person and they'll say, why do black people do that? Or why do black people say that? Or when I'm walking down the street, why do black people make that gesture? You know, I don't know who you are, first of all, and I can't answer for them because how do I know that you didn't say something to them or there was something that happened earlier? I can't answer that scenario. I can only say, if I was in that situation, then we have to look at the individual and we can't look at the whole group.
Because the best way for me to look at this is I get a lot of questions about being gay. Mm-hmm. Mother and father, other people, and they bring it all to me like I know the whole gay population. Mm-hmm. A lot of their questions are very offensive, or they stereotype, or they group us. And I try not to get defensive on them,
right.
because I would rather the
that's
question be asked
that's where your beginning question
than
was.
For them to, right. to assume things.
No, I do not get an attitude. Because I'm a firm believer, there was a shirt that came out back in, I think it was 1990s, and it was called, It's a Black Thing, You Wouldn't Understand. Mm-hmm. Oh, I hated that shirt. Mm-hmm. I hated that shirt. Because if you don't understand, it's my job to teach. And that's why I was glad when the shirt came out, Each One, Teach One. Mm-hmm. Because that's what it's all about. So, no, I don't get an attitude with the person. But I do say, you know what? I can't speak for the whole race. If you ask me about my experience, I can tell you that, but I can't answer for the whole race.
And then if someone says that to me, if someone says, you know, why do black people do this? I will answer their question, and then I will help them understand that that might not be an appropriate way to ask that question of another black person. Maybe the next time you might want to try it this way. Otherwise, they might be offended. So I'm not going to, I won't take an attitude. I don't generally take an attitude when someone says something unless I know that they mean to hurt me. I try to give people the benefit of the doubt. But if I know they mean to hurt me, I'm going to handle it a little differently. I'm still not going to be ugly, but I'm going to handle it differently. My response will be different.
Could you ask that in a way like, you know, I don't understand why certain black people do this. Do you have a better insight or something? Mm-hmm. Can you tell me?
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you know what you're saying? You have a better, you're asking me on my personal.
I've had that problem with like different cultures besides, you know, Hispanics, like Chinese. Mm-hmm. Chinese people, there's a lot of things I don't understand. Mm-hmm. I work in China. So
but that you ask, Billy, that you ask, I mean, that's huge. Someone comes ask me, I'm thinking they want to learn. Mm-hmm. And I am more than willing to help them learn. But you know what? The only way to learn is to ask. And you might ask the question in a way that might seem inappropriate to someone that you're asking it of. My hope is that you'll ask of someone who will be patient enough with you to answer your question and then help you ask it again.
Yeah, I try to do that because I realize I travel around a lot. There's a lot I don't know about certain cultures.
None of us know everything about every culture. You're absolutely right. We need to finish this up.
Yeah.
Okay, please don't minimize my experience. I'm going to say very little about this, even though it's been a lifetime of experience. And what I mean by this is that if If I share with you about an incident that has occurred, a racially driven incident that has occurred for me, like I didn't get served in a restaurant or I didn't get waited on in a department store, please don't make excuses for that white person that treated me badly. That's, to me, minimizing my experience, yes.
I know we're short on time, but can you share an experience to help us get a better?
I am more than happy to do that. Thank you.
We're dense, you know. I am.
Speak for yourself. There are people in this room and they want
to. The white people in the room, you speak for them.
I've been looking about four schools.
Make it okay.
An incident. Okay, one of my favorite ones to share is when I lived in Monterey. I'm in a jewelry store, very, very nice, exclusive jewelry store. I'm looking around. I had another experience in Tiffany's. Oh, that's another workshop. Okay, I'm in this jewelry store. I'm looking at the jewelry. The woman there is just her and me. She looks right through me. She doesn't acknowledge my presence. No hello, nothing. I'm still looking. I'm knowing what's going on, knowing the environment in which I'm living. But I'm still looking. A white couple came in. They barely got in the door. Hi, how are you? How may I help you today? And they said, oh, I think she wasn't, she here, she was here before us. And the woman said, oh, she's not buying anything.
Oh.
Now.
A mind reader. I was trying to be a mind reader also.
To say the least. Yeah. She didn't know me from Adam. Adam is my son. But she she did not know me. She'd never seen me before in her life. She could not look at me and know what's in my purse. She did not know, for all she knew, I could be, you know, Oprah's daughter that nobody knows about. I mean, she didn't know how much money I have. She did not have a clue who I was. And I will say to you that I was not dressed. I don't go out tacky. So I wasn't dressed shabby or tacky. I wasn't wearing cutoffs. I was dressed very decently. But she was looking at my skin, that's all she saw. And so then I shared that incident with Lynn. And she said, you know, well, maybe she just didn't see you. Duh. Yeah, I said, no, she did not see me. Well, maybe she just, you know, maybe she meant to help you, but then these people came in and she, I don't minimize my experience. Please don't make excuses for this woman. Don't make it seem like it's my fault that this woman didn't wait on me. And don't try to pretend that that was not an intensely hurtful experience for me. And I understand that when white people do this, I understand that sometimes it's just because they don't understand, or someone said in the last workshop, which I believe to be true, that they really want to believe that this is not happening anymore, that we're past that. Mm-hmm. The truth of the matter is, racism is alive and well. We are not past it. I've had people, white people, say to me, you know, we've just come such a long way. And I just go, well, okay. You know, that's not my experience. My experience is not that we've come a long way. My experience is that we've come a little ways. And people have learned to camouflage their racism better. But racism is alive and well. Homophobia is alive and well. Bigotry is alive and well in America. And I am so sorry that that's true, but it's true. So let's not minimize each other's experiences. Let's hear it and say, I am sorry that happened to you. And not victimize someone else.
I'm not angry when I choose to educate. You know, when someone says something to me, when they say one of these things, and I go, you know, what you just said was very offensive, and I think this is what you meant, coming from who I think, who I know you as to be, this is what I think you meant, but when you say that, this is how it makes me feel. People shouldn't assume that, oh, now he's offended, he's mad, now he's angry, he's angry
black man,
you know? No, I'm not angry. What I'm trying to do is that, one thing you should want is, thank God I ran into someone who's taking the time to help me instead of someone who punched me in the face because they got so mad and couldn't control their anger. They were angry, you know. What I'm doing is trying to say, this is the right way, the correct way that you probably should approach this. This is a suggestion on how you should go about it.
And final jokes. The word I would give you is just please don't tell ethnic jokes. And please don't allow people to tell them to you. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. When you hear someone telling an ethnic joke, if you feel strong enough to do so, please just say, I would rather not hear that. That's an ethnic joke. It's offensive to some people. If you're not able to do that, and not everyone is able to do that, I would encourage you to get up and leave. And hopefully that will make a statement to the person telling the joke. If you are a Polish person and you want to share a Polish joke with me, I will allow that. If you are Latino and you want to share a Latino joke with me, that's cool. If you are African American, absolutely. I may give you one. But if that is not who you are, I don't want to hear it. If you're not blonde, don't come up in my face with a blonde joke. I don't want to hear it. I don't want to hear anything that's derogatory against another person or group of people. So, yeah, if you're not short, don't tell short jokes. And you know what? If you're not big boned, don't be giving me big bones. I don't want to hear it. I just don't want to hear it. And I am one who will say, I don't want to hear that. And I would appreciate if you wouldn't tell those kinds of jokes in my presence. I will say that. Because I really want to make a point to that. I want them to know I'm offended, even though it may not be an African American joke. You know, you're talking about Latinos, and that's not okay with me.
And I know I'm not supposed to do this.
No, you're
not. I'm not supposed to do this. But you know, it's so funny because when people say to me, or people think, when they look at me, they don't see color, people start telling black jokes right in front of me. Mm-hmm. That are really mean and harsh jokes. And then they look at, and I'll say, I can't believe you just said that. And they'd be like, what? Like, you have no clue that you're standing right in front of a person in the club and you just told this nasty joke, mm-hmm. You know, so.
I get an email all the time, and I send back quite a sweet little reply. So these do's and don'ts are just some guidelines, and we offer suggestions as to how to deal with the situation. What I want to ask you to do is, when you're about to use these phrases, or when you hear other people, when you hear somebody else using some of these phrases, you know, I would encourage you to hear what they said and try to imagine what they must mean by that. Try to imagine what the recipient of that comment must be feeling. Because for me, I'm looking behind the words. I always look through the words. I cut straight to the person's heart. And if I feel that they don't mean any harm, you know, I will respond in a positive way. And then I will share with them another way to do it. If I believe that they really meant harm, that's another story. So all we're saying is that when you're about to embark upon any of these things, think about it first. Think about what your motivation is behind it. And act accordingly.
I'd like to add something to that. I think because this has been an issue for me, and I've said, you know, I don't see color. And I did not mean to offend anybody. It's very, really, I felt very, very badly that I did that. And my point of that is that it wasn't that I wasn't seeing colors. It doesn't matter to me. And so if you can say things sincerely and you know, just try to think about what you're doing and do it with, you know, a correct heart, people are going to understand. They're going to hear you. And then that's the way that you construct the dialogue to make the changes and get educated on what's appropriate and what's helpful.
You just took my picture. That was my Malcolm X. My Malcolm X look. I'm just saying, we all do that.
I was wondering, after the jewelry store incident or anything like that, I was wondering, two-part question, how long does it take you to recover from that? After you walk out, mm-hmm. And what did you say, think, that helped you recover?
It took a long time to recover. It took days, many, 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 many days. Partly because of where I was living in a racist environment anyway, and so other things would happen to stack on top of that, mm-hmm. So it would always trigger that incident. Mm-hmm. So it took a very, very, I couldn't wait to get out of Marlins. I couldn't wait. I was there for 6 years, six way too many years. Mm-hmm. But it took a long time, and I still, when I share that story, it still hurts. Mm-hmm. When she said that, I turned around and left. I didn't say anything to her. I walked out the door, and that was that. But I walked out the door broken, mm-hmm. and hurting. So how long did it take to recover? You know, obviously, you know, life goes on, and I went on. But there are things that happen that trigger that memory, and there are so many things that have piled on top of it. So
And sometimes,
what do you think? I mean, you just like pray, or
oh, you know, oh,
something, okay. Or what do you, how do you?
You know what? I always talk to God. That is something I always do. I always say, Lord, you know, just, you know, help me get past this. But then I also realize that that is an ignorant person. And I don't mean that in a derogatory sense. It's just a person who is not in the know. This is someone who is just not fully present where racial issues are concerned. And in all honesty, I tend to feel sorry for people like that. I don't hate that. I never hated that woman. I don't hate anybody. I do not hate her. I didn't dislike her. Yes, I was grossly offended by what she said. And had her, I seen her in another environment, I don't know, depending on the space I was in, I might have approached her and said something about it, not being ugly, but I might have gotten her involved in a conversation. If the opportunity presented itself, I would have said something about it. But I don't hate, and I get angry sometimes because it hurts. Mm-hmm. But I don't lash out at people, and I don't hate or dislike. And if I see people like that, you know, on the streets, I mean, someone who has offended me in one place and then I'm out in the streets and I see them again, you know, I may or may not say something to them. It's up to God. Let him open the door. If he opens the door, I will most certainly say something to them. But yes, I will pray for that person. But mostly I feel sorry for him.
It's hard for me. I don't recover very easily.
Yeah.
And how I don't recover is that it makes me, it leaves a sour taste in my mouth. Whenever I had an experience in a bar, a gay bar in Chicago, not too long ago, and it was strictly racial, and I don't go to that bar anymore. And the bad part about it is that my friends go, "This is where we're going," and I go, "I don't patronize that bar. Mm-hmm. I don't go to that bar. That's not a bar that I go to."
And I do that too. If I'm hurting in any kind of store or any, no matter where I am, if I'm hurt in that environment, chances are I'm not going back. I will never set foot in Tiffany's in San Francisco again, ever. That wasn't Tiffany's at the store yesterday, but I did have an incident there. I will never go there.
And that's part of it. You know, how I can't recover is that whenever I tell the story, I tell people, I didn't get served at Side Tracks. Mm-hmm. You know,
yes.
And I tell people, because when we share our stories, if we're not specific and letting people know that it's right in their own backyards, mm-hmm. then they won't right. believe that it exists.
Denny's. I don't go to Denny's. I will not go to Denny's.
Well, I won't go to Denny's either because of it.
Because it's nasty or because they did that other stuff? The lawsuit? See, I was a part of that lawsuit.
But then I wouldn't, if Keith told me that about the sidetrack thing, and I was his friend, I would be so pissed off. I wouldn't go to sidetrack.
Exactly.
And if I were you, I would get really ticked.
What?
If one of my so-called friends continued to go to sidetrack.
And they minimize.
Do that.
And so I don't go to Denny's, although in the Cracker Barrel, I do have to occasionally go. But there are apple stuff. But
okay, you scare me.
And my friends, the friends that, you know, did minimize that experience for me for that bar and continued to go there, you know, they finally got tired of going through the phase of saying, "Hey, we want to go out." "Oh, but you don't go there." They got tired of doing that, you know, until it started clicking for them. There was a problem here.
Yeah.
And my friend was affected by it. So if there's a place that I can't take my friend to, mm-hmm. then that's a lot of work for me to try to figure out something else. We can't just go walk into a place, mm-hmm. you know? It mm-hmm. started becoming real for them. Mm-hmm. And that's the reason why it's so important not to minimize people's experience.
But you do make a good point about friends. If I have an experience and I have a friend that continues to frequent that place and they know very well what happened to me, then what happens?
It's not pretty. It's just not good.
It hurts me. It hurts me.
I want to go to that jewelry store after they just did you like that.
I know. But see, that's a sign of true friendship. And there are other people. Again, you have to remember there are people who don't want to believe that this is really
happening. Absolutely.
Today.
That's true.
And then there are those who go, "Well, it happened to her, but it's not going to happen to me because I'm white." I'm sorry, but that's the reality. They know it's not going to happen to them, so they keep going. I have friends that continue to go to Denny's, and they know what happened to me there. I have a problem with that, but...
Let's get into our questions, yeah. We have time to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
I often go out into my life in places I enjoy and things I like to do and don't see many, if any, people of color and would like to. How can I make a difference and effect change such that the gap division becomes less? Wherever those places are that you go to, you know, and you would like to see a lot more people, then you, whoever's in charge, like connection. You know, people started, you know, when we started saying, you know, I don't see anybody but the two of us, you know. So then it's important to find out, well, how do I make the change? Who do I need to talk to say, here's a list of organizations that you can send stuff to. Now, if they don't come, that's not the thing that we have to worry about. But the fact that the step was made to them, for them to be invited. That's the main way that you can affect change, is by doing something. If you recognize it, then take a step to do something about it.
How to deal with discrimination when you are from a mixed family, i.e. grandparents are Hawaiian. When I was 6, we were kicked out of a restaurant because they thought my grandparents and my mother were black. Okay. Well, what I can say to that is that I'm from a mixed family as well. And I myself am multi-ethnic, although I realize it's difficult to see that, but I am multi-ethnic. And the only, I just think the best way to handle it is the way that you would handle it if you were in an interracial relationship. You know, if the person you're in a relationship with is of another ethnicity, how would you feel about that? You know, how would you handle that if someone discriminated against them? I mean, when people discriminate against your family, that hurts. You know, and I think the best way to deal with it, if the opportunity presents itself, is to deal directly with the establishment or the individual who has discriminated against that person, that loved one of yours. So if it's a restaurant, in this case it was a restaurant, I believe, yeah, it was a restaurant. See, when I had my experience in Denny's, I went straight to the manager, the white manager. But I went straight to the manager, I don't care what color he was. I wanted him to know this had happened to me in the establishment that he was managing. I knew he wasn't going to do anything about it because I already knew his attitude when he came to me. I didn't care. I told him, and I never went back. I would say I would not go back there. I wouldn't go back there with my grandparents. I wouldn't go back there by myself with my friends. I wouldn't go back. But I would most certainly go and speak to a higher up in the establishment if the opportunity presents itself. I realize there are times when you cannot do that, but that's how I would handle it.
As a school social worker, I participated in many kinds of things that attempt to address racism. But I have never participated in anything like this in the Christian community. I'm sorry. Okay.
I just thought, who was that school social worker? That's me.
But I've never participated in anything like this in the Christian community. Is there much dialogue happening in the Christian community? Mm-hmm. It depends on where you are. Mm-hmm. It depends on where you are and what's going on. I can guarantee you almost 9 times out of 10 that a white Lutheran church is not going to bring up the issues of racism as a church that may be integrated, that may be a mixture of people. I go to a predominantly, one of the churches I go to in Chicago, which is a predominantly white church, is Unity in Chicago. And so what happened was, same thing happened that happened here at EC. We realized there's a lot about the African American culture that people don't know about. So a group got together, a committee got together called Blacks in Unity. And now we're the ones who put on Black History programs, we put on Juneteenth programs, and we do everything I can to make sure that there are multiracial speakers that come into our church, because we realize that's our home just as well as everybody else's home. So, is there much dialogue happening in the Christian community? I think this is one of the few places in a Christian setting, besides in a black church, that will bring up racism, that I ever hear people bring up the idea or the thoughts of how do we erase racism.
And I can say to you that when I was young, much younger, a child, the church that I went to was an African American church, Baptist church, and we were in relationship with a Presbyterian white church, and the reason my church was in relationship with this church was because we wanted to sever the color lines in the city that I grew up in, which is an unbelievable amount of racism. But we wanted to cut those lines, and so we purposely did things together, they would come to our church for services, and we would go to their church, or we'd have functions. And it was wonderful, but we were the only two churches in that city that were doing that, that were crossing those color lines. So the dialogue, as Keith said, it doesn't, I don't find that it's happening much in churches, unless, or Christian communities, unless you have someone in a particular community who is aware and who wants to bring change. Otherwise, it's not going to happen on its own. Okay. I'm going to take these two together because one of them we sort of addressed already. The first one says, greater awareness of discrimination and racism within EC and the larger gay community. To Keith and Davina, how were you treated specifically at your first ECWR conference? And I did share about number four. But just to add a little bit more to that, to say that I was treated very well at my first, and every connection since then.
Absolutely.
I was treated very, very well. I mean, my first connection, I mean, people got me so involved. I was on that stage more than the MC. People treated me very, very well. And these people that made these comments, like I said to you before, I believe that they were not in any way trying to offend me or hurt me. They didn't know how to say what they were saying. So people have been wrong to me. And I also know that there are people here who have racist issues and issues of bigotry. Hence my participation on this committee. Who's the one who erased that stuff?
The only way we are ever going to be able to adopt change is, you know, we can sit back forever and say, they're never going to know anything about us. They're never going to figure out anything about our culture. But until we bring it to the table and say, we need to be heard and we need to help try to figure out how do we become a true body of Christ.
And I will say to you very briefly in wrapping that part up that there are plenty of African Americans who refuse to teach workshops like this. And their argument is, racism is not my problem, it's their problem. And to that I would say, you're absolutely right. But how are they going to learn? They are not willing to change because they are the majority. I'm saying they. They are the majority. They don't feel a need to change. We have to teach them. We have to help them along the way. So I can't stand that day stuff anyway. Has there been any movement in the problem of racism in the past 10 to 20 years? I would say yes, there has been movement. I would say movement has been small, but I would say yes, there has been movement. And I believe that movement will continue. I just don't agree with those individuals who say, God, we've come such a long way. I don't agree with that at all. I don't believe we've come such a long way. I believe that we've been tolerated a little bit more. I believe we've been patronized more. And I believe that there has been a little bit of movement. Thank you, Jesus. And I believe that that movement will continue as long as we continue to have these types of dialogues. People are open and willing to look inside and see what's going on in there, deal with what's going on in there, get honest with themselves, deal with it, work through it. That's when I think that real movement will happen. Until we're willing, really willing to get honest about what's going on inside, and then decide to make a change, if that in fact needs to happen. It's not going to happen. Tracy,
what?
When he's done, would you please, I want me to remember to have you close in prayer. Thank you.
What's it like to be Black, African American, Christian, and gay?
That's another workshop.
Do you feel like you have two strikes against you? I actually feel like I have three strikes against me because I'm Black, I'm gay, and I'm male. I feel for me that that's three strikes against me. Mm-hmm. Because in the gay community, you know, I have to face and deal with racism. Being Black and a male, I have to face with being the stereotype. Mm-hmm. It depends on how I'm dressed, depends on how I'm served. Mm-hmm. If I wear jogging pants in a store, then 9 out of 10 I won't be served. But if I walk in a store and I'm in a suit, then I won't be followed. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. To me, I feel that I have three.
You know, I think you have four, because you like white guys.
Well,
I know that's right.
And you know, you're absolutely right about that, because I face issues within not only, you know, an outside community, even within my own African American gay community. You know, I face the ostracism because I date predominantly white men.
And I have a fifth. Well, I'll correct one of his because I am not male. You can be male. I just don't want to be. But I have a fifth one, and that is that I'm a single parent. And so I have to contend with that discrimination as well. So for us, it's big. You want to know what it's like? Read the book.
We can talk.
Read the book.
It's a hard life, you know, and it has its challenge. But you know, I'm so glad that God has blessed me to be a strong person, because there's a lot of things in life I would not have been able to withstand if I had not had God. Mm-hmm. I know that without a shadow of a doubt.
And I will go a step further and say that I believe that the vast majority of the African American community in this country are very strong people because of what we as an ethnicity, as a group, as a people, have had to endure. I think about my ancestors and I think, my goodness, you know, what would could I have made it as a slave? You know, in that form of slavery I have had to endure my own form, but could I have made it? Yeah, I believe I could have. And I believe it's because, you know, there's lots of reasons why the slaves made it. A lot of it was spiritual. A lot of it was because of their faith. But I believe that as a people, African Americans are strong people, because we have to be in order to survive in an extremely racist environment. We have to have a choice. You're going to be strong or die.
I don't know if this is a question or just a comment, but many years ago, I was the secretary to the director of human resources at Wheaton College, and Wheaton, kind of well-known conservative Christian college, and my boss he said, and I've heard this before, that they are forced to hire. The EEO says you have to hire black people, a certain percentage of black people, and whether they're qualified for the job or not, we have to do it. And then he would say, and I've heard this from other people too, and we can't fire them because they'll sue us. And it just, maybe just, can you comment on that or something?
Because that's big. And so that's a whole other workshop.
Yeah.
But I guess that, you know, there is that EOE law, Equal Opportunity Employer, you know, and it's just huge. I mean, that same issue is in schools in terms of education. You're talking employment, but even in terms of admissions, that's a whole other issue. And when you say, can you comment on that, I'm not sure where you want us to go, because
I'm going to tell you where I'm going to go. I'm a person, I don't believe, I'm glad that affirmative action exists, because it does allow the door to be open for some people, but I don't believe that you should give me the job just because I'm black. Mm-hmm. I want you to give me the job because I am qualified. And if you do fire me, I want to be able to know what the real reason why I'm being fired, and it to be legit. You know, I think when it comes down to things like that, you're going to have people on all wavelengths of how they want to respond to that. And the person, it's just like, there are so many gay people. You know, the first thing they jump to when they get fired, even though they've been late 20 times, they fire me because I'm gay. No, they fired me because you spend 20 minutes in the mirror doing your hair. You know, so for me, I don't believe that anybody should be given any special put. But I'm glad that equal opportunity is important and it's out there, because it at least allows the door to be open for someone who may not be able to even come into the door.
And it's important that you understand what's behind that, and what is behind that is just blatant discrimination. And so the law was put into practice because people of color have not been able to take advantage of opportunities. So it's just that it's a very fine line. And like Keith, I want the job because I'm qualified. I don't want it because I'm African-American. I want it because I'm qualified. Once I go into an environment because I'm African-American, if people know that that's why I'm there, I'm going to be treated badly because they're going to resent it.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Does that
touch on it?
You? Yeah. Okay. Do you want to be sinner pray?
Let's bow our heads for a word of prayer. Dear Heavenly Father, blessings on ECWR. Blessings on tonight, our night of restoration.
Thank you, God.
And I want to thank you for the people who support this committee.
Yes,
this committee. The people who've come to the workshops, the people who have participated in the forums, and all of the people who put themselves out there as willing and interested and able to help have ECWR fully reflect the body of Christ.
Yeah.
So that Christians who are gay can find a place to come and be reconciled with you. In thy name I pray.
Amen. Amen. Let all people say
amen. Amen.